passageway. She had no choice but to proceed. It was difficult with the chains on, but she managed to crawl painfully and slowly. The walls were smooth and worn, as if many bodies had passed through that narrow, low tunnel. At the end of the passage, a pair of hands pulled her up, and she had to close her eyes to the brightness of the sun. When she could finally open them, she saw that beautiful white sand lay in front of her. The salty smell that she had grown accustomed to was now overwhelming. As her eyes adjusted to the light, Amari cast her eyes for the first time upon the ocean. Travelers had occasionally come to her village, so she had heard tales of the blueness and vastness of the ocean. But nothing could have prepared her for water so blue, so beautiful, so never-ending. After so many days of the darkness of her cell, the glory of that view was powerful and very, very frightening. Would she be thrown into the sea? And what was that strange house in the distance that seemed to rest on the surface of the water? It could not be a boat. Boats were small and held one or two people. Boats were used for fishing or visiting family members downriver. This was huge, with white fabric dancing from it. That could not be a boat, Amari decided. It must be a place of the dead. Before she had a chance to absorb it all, a man dragged her to what looked like a goat pen. A fire burned brightly in the center of it, even though the day was very warm, and the man was steering her toward it, Amari realized with fear. Am I going to be cooked and eaten now? Why couldn't I have died with my family? She thought wildly. Panicked, she tried to pull away from the man, but his grip only tightened. A black man who spoke the language of the white men pushed her roughly down into the sand and held her firmly so she could not move. Amari could see only the feet of the second man, but he moved toward the fire, leaned down to pick something up, then walked purposefully toward her. Intense, fiery pain pierced the sweaty softness of the skin above her left shoulder. Amari could hear her flesh sizzle, and she nearly fainted as she realized she was being branded. Like a wounded animal, Amari screamed and screamed. Why? Was the only thought in her head. Someone then pulled her away from the fire, smeared a horrible-smelling salve on her wound, and yanked her over to another holding pen full of prisoners like her, all dazed from the pain of the hot branding iron. Many of them sat hunched over, trying to nurse their wounds. A few stared at the pale blue sky, the deep blue of the unbelievable expanse of water, and the death house that tossed on the waves in the distance. The salve must have been effective, for the intense pain gradually subsided and was replaced by a duller throbbing that would not go away. Amari saw then that Afi had emerged from the prison as well. When she was branded, she did not cry out. Amari could see the pain on her face, and the tears rolled down her cheeks, but Afi did not utter a sound. Afi was thrown into the holding pen soon after that, and they hugged each other gently, avoiding the fiery sores on their shoulders. What happens now? Amari whispered. Child, I've heard stories, but I've never seen the ocean before. I have heard that the water spills over the edge of the world, and that only death is found there. There has to be something on the other side of the great water, Amari reasoned. The white soldiers had to come from whatever that place is. It must be a place of death for sure, Afi replied, agreeing with Amari. For only such a horrible place could create such creatures who could burn a person with a flaming hot iron. Amari started to remind her that they had been held down by people of their own land, people who looked just like them. But at that moment, several men were shoved into the holding cell. Three of them were some of the very same Ashanti warriors who had helped to capture the people from her village. They looked stunned at their sudden change in status. Another new captive, who looked positively irate, was the black man who had just held Amari down on the sand while she was branded. He held his freshly branded shoulder and called out in the language of the whites, but they ignored him. The last man to be tossed into the pen was Besa. The men had been kept from the women, housed in a separate section of the prison. Amari had not seen Besa since they had arrived. He was thin and filthy, and looked absolutely beautiful to her. She wanted to call out his name, run to him, and hug him, but she found she could say nothing as he was taken to the far corner of the holding pen and chained there. Besa looked up and gazed directly at Amari for just a moment. His face, once so proud and happy, showed only defeat. She understood. The pen offered no shelter from the intense heat of the day. No water was offered to them. Men in uniform, and men with obvious power and authority, strode across the sand all afternoon, clearly preparing for something. But what? Amari wondered. Then several of them climbed into a small boat that rocked and tossed in the waves of the large water, and they rowed out to the floating house in the distance. The boat returned with more men in uniform and a load of heavy chains. Amari knew they were for them. The sunset that evening was unlike any Amari had ever seen. The spirit of the copper sun seemed to bleed for them as it glowed bright red against the deepening blue of the great water. It sank slowly, as if saying farewell. The shadows deepened, and darkness covered the beach. As night fell, the leaders of the captors ordered small fires to be made on the beach, and Amari soon smelled the welcome odor of food cooking. It had been a long time since they had been given anything to eat, and she was amazed when the holding pen was opened and generous portions of water and food, fresh fruit, a boiled cassava, and some kind of fish stew were distributed to them. Nobody questioned the offering, and the food was consumed greedily and quickly. Licking her fingers, she asked Afi, "Why do they feed us so well tonight?"
"To prepare us for the journey, I believe."
"What journey?" Afi hesitated. "Tell me," Amari urged.
"We will be taken to the boat of death on the horizon, and we will never see this place again."
Her voice chilled Amari, even more than the brisk wind that blew off the ocean. "I do not understand."
"We are slaves, Amari. Slaves."
"I know this." Amari knew, of course, what slaves were. Some of the wealthier elders in her own village had a few slaves. They had been won in battle or traded in negotiations between villages and tribes. They were usually respected and sometimes even adopted as extended members of a family.
"But this is not like anything we've ever known, is it?"
Amari asked her. She braced herself for Afi's answer.
"No, child. Horrors unimagined, I feel, will assault us."
Amari thought back to the night she was captured, and the journey to this place. Her mind could not imagine worse. She shivered in the night air, the brand on her shoulder throbbing. She thought of Kwasi, the little bird who would never fly again, but in a way, she was glad he would not have to endure any of these horrors. Finally, leaning against the pole she was tied to, she managed to fall asleep.
Chapter 6. From Sand to Ship. Amari awoke stiff, sore, and very cold the next morning. Small beach-living insects had feasted on her skin overnight, and she scratched at the red bites that covered her legs and arms. She looked around in alarm, because the dark wall of Cape Coast Castle, which had surrounded her every night since coming to this place, had disappeared. Then she remembered the small door, the bright sand, the blue water, and the fiery burn on her shoulder. Afi, already awake, looked at her without smiling. "Today is the day, Amari." Amari did not need to ask her for what. They were all fed generously once again, and more salve was applied to their wounds. The men were then kicked and yelled at, shackled back together, and marched out of the pen. Besa was the last in line. He turned and glanced back at Amari with a look that said, "I would have been a good husband, Amari. I would have loved you more with every sunrise and sunset." Then he was gone. Amari pulled her shackled hands up to her face. The chains rattled in rhythm to her sobs. "You knew him?" Afi asked her. "Yes, he is from my village. We were captured on the same day." "He is special to you, am I right?"
"Oh, yes," Amari told her, a small smile breaking through her tears. "We were to be married."
Her smile faded then. "You must forget him," Afi told her harshly.
"But,"
Amari protested, "he is dead to you now. Just as your parents and your brother and my family are dead, gone to be with the ancestors."
"But why, Afi? Why must I let go of the only link to who I truly am?"
"What you are is a slave," Afi told her, her voice cold and firm. "You have been bought by men who will sell your body and will do with it what they want. You can be beaten and raped and killed, and your young man can do nothing about it."
"You are cruel," Amari cried, shaking with anger.
"I am honest," she replied sadly.
"So why should I endure this? Why did you not let me just die in there?" Amari cried out.
"Because I see a power in you."
Afi lifted her shackled wrist and reached over to touch Amari.
"You know, certain people are chosen to survive. I don't know why, but you are one of those who must remember the past and tell those yet unborn. You must live."
"But why?"
"Because your mother would want you to. Because the sun continues to shine. I don't know, but you must."
She said nothing else, just sat down and began tracing pictures in the sand with her finger.
Amari had little time to mourn Besa's removal, or her own past or future, however.
The soldiers came for the women next. They were herded together, then lined up and shackled, two by two.
Afi was chained to Amari, to her great relief. She tried to stay calm, but it was impossible. It was terrifying, not to be able to understand what was happening and not to know what was to come. She saw she wasn't the only one. Some of the other women screamed and tried to grab handfuls of sand as they were forced out of the holding pen. Led across the sand, Amari found it surprisingly hard to walk. Her feet sank with every step. As they got closer to the edge of the beach, Amari noticed that the water never stopped moving, sending huge waves of itself against the sand, first blue, then white, then blue again, bubbling, churning, even leaping onto the land. It seemed to Amari that the ocean was reaching out to grab and devour her. Many of the women backed away from the surf and were promptly lashed. Amari was frightened, But she knew the water would not kill her. Not today. She watched as the last of the men were loaded into small rowboats, which rocked wildly on the waves. Some of the men cried out in terror. The boats became smaller as they got closer to the death house in the distance. Then Amari could see them no more. A set of empty rowboats, much larger than Amari had first thought, awaited the next group of captives. The women were pushed from the soft warmth of the sand to the water-soaked beach, and Amari very quickly found herself standing in water up to her knees. She screamed in spite of herself at the sudden coldness of the water and its constant movement against her legs. It crashed against her as if it were angry, and seemed to be trying to pull Amari away from the land. Her feet could not find a safe place. The sand beneath the water kept shifting. The water splashed onto her face, and she discovered with surprise that it was salty, like tears. Afi, sloshing in the shallows just ahead of Amari, was knocked sideways by a wave and fell, taking Amari with her. They both struggled to raise their heads above the water, but the weight of their leg and neck irons pulled them down. Water seeped into Amari's mouth and nose. She could not even scream. Their captors cursed and hauled Afi and Amari up, then shoved them into the small rowboat. Afi breathed hard and tried not to show how frightened she was. Amari felt no need to hide her fear. She gripped the side of the boat fiercely and shrieked with every swell of the water, with every spray of water in her face. As the captives were loaded into the boat, it rocked and tilted as if it were about to toss them into the water once more. And then the boat left the shore. 40 terrified women and girls howled as the boat began to float upon the sea. The soldiers on shore laughed at their fright, and the sailors on board beat them with their whips. Amari's arms and face were lashed and sliced as she huddled with Afi in the bottom of the boat, trying to get away from the sailors' ferocity. "Why do they beat us?" Amari thought wildly. "To silence us? To stop our fear?" Nothing made sense. The screaming gradually subsided into deep, burning groans, which no salve could soften. Amari lifted her head and looked around. The land was quickly disappearing, the soldiers looking like miniatures of themselves as they dragged another coffle of slaves into another small boat. She could hear the cries of the seabirds above and the rhythmic splash of the oars as the rowers carried them away from her land and closer to the huge ship waiting for them. She looked back with longing at the land of her birth. Amari knew that she would never see this place again. Chapter 7. Ship of Death. The water, which never stopped rocking the small boat, carried them swiftly to the side of the huge ship. As they got closer, she knew she had been right. It was a place of death. Amari could not see the top of it. It rested upon the great water like a beast, ready to swallow them all up, she felt. Two of the captives who had been yoked together grew hysterical as they approached the looming structure and leaped without warning into the sea. The slave women gasped as one. Amari did not know the language of her captors, but she could tell they cursed as nets were cast overboard for the escaped slaves. Amari and the other prisoners in her boat watched, however, in horrid fascination as the two women, a mother and daughter, tried in vain to swim back to shore. The mother struggled to keep her daughter afloat, but the chains were heavy, and they were weak from hunger and captivity. Suddenly, the mother disappeared from sight for a moment, only to reemerge screaming in agony. The ocean bled bright red. Two huge gray fish with fins of silver surfaced for just a moment, their backs gleaming in the sunlight.
One of them clenched a brown arm in its teeth. Then both mother and daughter disappeared. Amari stared at the spot, waiting for them to reappear. They didn't. She had held her breath through the whole thing. She was so stunned, she could not even pray. The sailors were now even angrier than before. The whips slashed across the backs of the remaining slaves once more, as if those still alive had to pay for the loss of the two who had died. No one else tried to jump. A rough plank had been rigged for them to climb from the small boat to the ship. It was narrow and shaky, but the sailors made sure the women had no opportunity to escape into the sea, should they dare. When she got to the deck, Amari stood amazed. It was like a small city made of wood. Poles taller than any tree reached to the sky. Loud, flapping pieces of cloth, larger than a hut, were attached to the poles by ropes, some of which were thicker than her whole body. Barrels and boxes littered the area, and dozens of men ran around shouting at one another and clapping one another on the back. They were laughing and cheerful, but Amari noticed that everyone seemed to carry a weapon, a gun, a sword, a knife. Confused and frightened, she didn't know what to think. Amari had very little time to think anyway. A whip lashed across her shoulder as she gazed around the ship, and she was quickly jolted back to reality. She jumped and yelped at the sudden pain. She and the other women were herded to one side of the deck, where a hole in the floor waited. They were pushed into that hole and slid down into what Amari knew just had to be the underworld. She wished that she had breathed more of the fresh air on the deck and in the boat, for the air in this place seemed to have been sucked out and replaced with the smells of sweat and vomit and urine. The male slaves had all been loaded before them, and she looked in disbelief at the sight before her. On narrow shelves made of wood, hundreds of naked men and boys lay chained together, wrists, necks, and legs held tightly by iron shackles. Only a few inches separated one man from another. Each man had about 6 inches of headroom, not even enough to sit up. Under the upper level of boards, a second level had been constructed, and under that, a third. Each row of shelves held men, human beings, chained like animals and stacked like logs for the fire, row after row, shelf after shelf. The first row seemed to have more headroom and breathing area, but the second and third rows beneath them were already slimy with waste. The men on the bottom were splattered with the blood of the men who had been beaten, as well as the vomit and urine and feces that the men chained above them had no choice but to eliminate where they lay. A large rat ran across Amari's feet as they were marched past the men. She felt faint. Surely this could not be real. Some of the women cried out as they found a man they knew. Amari did not want to see Besa tied like an animal. She turned her head and moved on. The area for the women was in a separate location. Their feet were locked in leg irons, and they had only the rough boards to lie upon. But Amari noticed that they had more room and that the air was a bit fresher. Nor were they stacked the way the men were. Amari was surprised to notice a number of children in their area. The men who had captured her group had killed all of the children. She had supposed because they were too much trouble to take care of. But the captives on this ship, as she found out later on the journey, came from all over Africa, and by many different ways. Amari saw a small boy who huddled near his mother. He was about the same age as Kwasi had been. She wished for a moment that he had lived, so that she could hold him and comfort him. Then she shook that thought free. She would never want him to know these horrors. The ship of death was surprisingly very much alive. It inhaled and exhaled the foul air of where they lay chained, and it rolled with the rhythm of the water. Loud noises echoed down to them, pounding, clanging, and screeching, and it seemed the white men were always shouting. She also heard laughter above. No one in the hidden dark area beneath the ship laughed. All were silent with fear. Eventually, the activity above seemed to slow down. Amari felt a sense of anticipation, as if something was about to happen. Perhaps it was night, she could not tell. Afi, still chained next to her, quietly began to hum an old Eve song. It was the lament sung at a funeral, a death song. She sang to the ancestors and to the other slaves. Gradually, even those not of that tribe joined in. Close to 100 women sang softly with her. It was the saddest sound Amari had ever heard. Chapter 8. Toward the Edge of the World. Hours passed. It was impossible to tell if it was day or night. Amari was unbelievably hungry and had to relieve herself. She was still chained and had no idea what she should do. She nudged Afi, who, as usual, was watchful and awake.
"Feel the motion of this ship of death," Afi whispered.
Amari could feel a gentle rocking, rhythmic and constant.
"It feels different somehow," she told her.
"We float on the face of the sea," Afi murmured, "and we travel toward the edge of the world."
Amari started to ask her how she knew, but then she decided to trust Afi's instincts.
"There is no escape?" Amari asked, even though she was certain of the answer.
"Not only is there no escape, there is no land to escape to. They have stolen that as well."
Amari did not understand. She had no time to ask her, for at that moment several sailors, with claws tied around their faces, came down, unchained the feet of the women, and led them up out of the hold. After climbing the ladder up to the deck, Amari gasped with astonishment. Afi was right. The land had indeed disappeared. Bright blue water surrounded them. The beach, the fort, the small boats, everything had vanished. One woman lurched at the sight, grabbed Amari's arm, and squeezed it so tightly that she left marks. She mumbled words in the language Amari did not understand. Another woman fainted. Some covered their eyes from the sudden brightness, and others cried out fearfully. Afi said nothing. She had known. The sailors began throwing salt water on the women from buckets on the deck. The water stung Amari's wounds and coated her with brine. Other women twitched and howled as the water hit them, and the sailors laughed at their discomfort. A barrel had been set on one side of the deck for the women to relieve themselves, and they were given food, some kind of beans mixed with an oily substance that Amari could not identify. It was horrible, and she gagged as she swallowed it, but she ate it all. A sailor spoke sharply to the women, and they all stared at him blankly. He repeated himself again and again. "Now you dance! Dance! Dance, you monkeys, dance!" None of them had any idea what he meant. Finally, a young white man who looked to be about Amari's age brought out a small drum and began pounding a beat. It was just a simple, basic rhythm. Drum-dum-rum-dum-drum-bop-bop. Drum-dum-rum-dum-drum-bop-bop. Over and over again. The women looked around in confusion. The dull beat made by that foreign drum carried no message and certainly offered no cause for celebration. It has none of the life and voice our drummers were able to coax from a drum, Amari thought. A whiplash stung Amari's face, and she jumped. The sailor holding the whip nodded, pointed to her, and jabbered some words as he hopped up and down. Amari then realized what the men wanted them to do. They expect us to dance, or at least jump to this horrible rhythm, Amari thought incredulously. Slowly, reluctantly, the women began to jump. Amari supposed it was for exercise, but it was also for another purpose, she noticed with a sickening realization. Most of the female captives had on very little clothing. Their clothes had been ripped and torn and stripped from them since they had been taken from their homes. The sailors, all carrying knives or guns, walked among the women as they danced. They watched the women closely, sometimes touching their bodies. The women knew what the men were looking for. One of them, a huge man with bright orange hair, kept watching Amari. She had never seen a person with hair that color before, and he frightened as well as fascinated her. He never touched her, but while the women danced, she noticed he kept his eyes on her face rather than on the rest of her body. At the end of the dance, instead of being taken back down to the hold where they had been chained all night, the women were tied to the sides of the deck. The children were untied and allowed to run free. "Keep your child close to you," Afi told one mother. "Who knows what these strange men like to eat?" The mother nodded and grabbed the boy. It wasn't exactly pleasant on the deck of the ship. It was dreadfully hot, and the constant salty wind on her face only increased her thirst. They had been given no fresh water to drink since that first meal of the morning, but Amari was glad to be away from the stench of the bottom of the ship. "They will come for us tonight," Afi whispered to Amari, jarring her thoughts back to a harsh reality. "They treat us like animals, but tonight we will be forced to be their women."
But I do not know what to do," Amari wailed, thinking with embarrassment of her dreams of lying in Besa's arms after they were married.
"Submit in silence. If you fight back, it will go worse for you," Afi said sadly.
"Perhaps it is better to die," Amari told her sharply.
Afi sighed. "If you die, they win. We cannot let that happen."
"They have already taken everyone I loved," Amari replied, ashamed to look at Afi in the face. "And tonight they take the only thing I have left that is truly mine. Death would be a relief."
"You will live because you must," Afi said sternly.
"I should welcome death, but I cannot.
Not yet. And neither can you."
She turned away from Amari and looked out at the sea. Amari did not know how to reply. She trembled violently at the thought of one of these strange, smelly, milk-faced men taking her against her will.
"Shall I throw myself overboard?" she thought.
"It would be so much easier to give up and die."
Yet she could not do that,
and she didn't know why.
The male captives were brought to the deck next, a few at a time. They also screamed as the salt water was thrown on them, and then they were forced to perform the same horrible dance. Amari listened to the thunder that their feet made and thought ruefully, "The feet of my people bring forth rhythm even when the noise of the white man can produce none." Afi nudged Amari and whispered,
"Death has come for some of us."
Amari stared as several bodies, stiff and lifeless, were pulled from the decks below. The sailors, again with cloths tied around their mouths and noses, unceremoniously tossed the dead men overboard. Amari was too numb to even remember the words of a prayer. The male slaves, unlike the women, were not allowed to stay on the deck after they had been fed and made to dance. They were whipped and chained and led back to the fetid dungeon where they had been all night. Every hour a few more were brought up and put through the same routine until at last there were no more. The sailors cleaned up the deck and whistled cheerfully. Night was approaching. Amari looked at the sun as it disappeared into the sea. It burned coppery bright and beautiful. She tried to sear that beautiful sight on her memory as a shield to the ugliness that she now knew was about to happen. Chapter 9. Lessons. Painful and otherwise. When night finally enveloped the ship, and only a wisp of the moon shone dimly, the deck was dark except for the light from the torches the sailors used. Like pigs in heat, they came for the women. One by one, the women were unchained and dragged, screaming and kicking, to a distant area of the ship or a corner of the deck. Amari heard them plead for mercy, for understanding, but no one listened. Two men grabbed Afi and led her away. She lowered her head and did not cry out or try to fight them. Amari huddled in a corner, trying to make herself look like one of the children, trying to look lame or stupid or unappealing. But then someone grabbed her arm. She looked up. It was the sailor with bright reddish hair. She moaned. He pulled Amari to a small room that held nothing but a box made of wood, and a sleeping area that seemed to be elevated off the floor somehow. "These men don't even sleep on mats on the ground?" she thought briefly. But then the horror of what was about to happen overwhelmed her, and she looked around wildly for a means of escape. The man closed the door, and the room was suddenly very small. His large body took up most of the area and completely blocked the door. He pushed Amari roughly onto the floor. She could hear the cries and screams of the other women as they were being attacked. "Scream!" he yelled at her harshly. Amari did not know what he meant, so she just sat there, about to faint from fright. "Scream!" the red-headed sailor yelled again. And this time he raised his huge hairy arm as if to hit her. Amari screamed. He mumbled some words and seemed to be pleased. Then he put his finger to his lips and whispered, "Shh." It was the same sound Amari used to make for Kwasi when she wanted him to be quiet. Her whole body shook with dread and fear. The sailor spoke more words, but to Amari they sounded like wooden buckets clattering together. She could make no sense of any of it. His voice sank to just above a whisper as he put his large hand across Amari's mouth so she could not make a sound. She could barely breathe. "He's going to kill me," she thought with terror. But he removed his hand and signaled for her to remain silent. She did. He spoke more words that she could not understand, rattling on as if she understood. Amari had no idea what he was talking about, but he did not seem to be in a hurry to rape her, so she relaxed a little. He grabbed a pouch around his neck, and Amari tensed, ready to cry out again. Slowly, he pulled an object from the pouch and handed it to Amari. At first, she was afraid to take it, fearing it might be a means to poison her or put a spell on her. But he smiled as he handed it to her, so she took it hesitantly. It was small, not much bigger than the palm of her hand, and made of wood. It was a carving of a child, a white child with long strands of hair. Amari looked at it in wonder, thinking it must be some kind of talisman. The sailor pointed to the carving and then pointed to himself several times. Then he took the small carving away from Amari, kissed it gently, and pretended to rock it. "Either this is a madman, or that is a likeness of his child,"
Amari thought. Child, the sailor said. Amari said nothing. My child, the sailor repeated.
Confused, Amari had no idea what he was saying. She coughed a little. He pointed to a bucket of water on the floor and made sipping motions as he lifted a dipper. She nodded slightly, and very gently, considering the size of the man, he gave her a dipper of water. It was cool and fresh, and she drank it thirstily.
Water, he said, pointing to it.
Amari wasn't sure what he meant.
Water, he said again. Water. 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 Water.
He kept repeating the word and pointing to the liquid.
Wa-ta,
she said slowly. The large sailor slapped his thigh and laughed. Amari looked at him cautiously, not sure what to say or do next.
Water, he said once more.
Wa-ta,
Amari repeated.
Bucket,
he said, kicking the bucket with his foot. Amari thought once more that surely this man must be mad. Why would he do such a thing?
Bucket,
he repeated, pointing to the wooden object now lying on its side.
Baka,
Amari repeated quickly, suddenly understanding. He was teaching her the language of the white skins.
Baka,
she said again, more clearly this time. If he was going to teach her, she fully intended to learn it. She hated not knowing what the sailors were saying. Amari thought briefly of her father, who loved meeting men of other tribes and learning their languages. Then she inhaled sharply and squeezed her arms around her body, the painful reality hitting her that her father would never again discover a new word or idea to share with her. The sailor looked at her with what looked like concern and jumbled out words that seemed to be a question, but Amari just shook her head. She felt that her father's spirit was there with her, and that somehow he had protected her this night from the certainty of rape. Hesitantly, Amari pointed to the door of the small cabin. He told her the word was door. She repeated it over and over until she could remember it. The strange red-headed sailor taught Amari the words ocean and ship and man and floor and wall, as well as many other simple words and phrases. She also asked him, through pointing and signs, to tell her the words for chain and whip and shackle. He frowned, but he told her. Knowledge of the language of the white men was a powerful weapon that she could possibly use one day to her advantage. Coldly and thoughtfully, she listened and learned. After a couple of hours, when most of the screams of anguish from the women had long since ceased, he opened the door of the small room and led Amari back to the deck. He made sure she had fresh water, let her relieve herself, and tied her gently to the deck pole, which he told her was called a mast. Then he disappeared. Most of the women back on deck were curled into balls, shivering in the chill night air. Some rocked back and forth, trying to erase the terrible memories of the past few hours. Afi, wide awake as usual, waited for Amari. Her face was bruised, her upper lip bleeding.
He did not take you?
Amari shook her head no, almost ashamed that she had escaped the fate of most of the women.
He was kind to you?
Amari thought about it and realized that what had happened to her really was one drop of kindness in this huge sea of evil that surrounded them. She nodded her head yes. She was afraid to look Afi in the eye.
Good. You were lucky. This night. But prepare yourself, child. One of them, probably many of them before this journey is over, will take you. Amari gasped.
How much longer can this journey be? She asked Afi, suddenly very frightened again. Surely the next day will bring us to our destination, wherever that might be.
In spite of her injuries, Afi managed to twist her lips into a rueful laugh.
No, child. This is just the beginning of many nights of horrible humiliation. I feel that this journey will be very long.
Amari touched Afi gently.
Many will die, Afi said quietly.
Some will live, but will die inside.
Others will pray for death and be forced to live. But we all will be changed forever.
She did not cry or wail as some of the other women did, but Afi's face was covered in tears, which mixed with the blood on her face and lips.
What shall we do?
Amari said finally, burrowing into Afi's arms as much as their chains would allow.
Find strength from within, Afi told her, stroking her head.
How do I do that?
Amari whimpered.
It is there. You will know when it is time to use that strength as your shield from what they will do to you.
Amari suddenly felt overwhelmed with powerlessness.
I want it to be like it was, she sobbed. I want my mother.
Oh, child, Afi whispered gently. I know you do.
It's not fair, Amari cried.
Nobody promised us happiness or fairness, child. I have known much happiness in my life. The love of a good man, children, a village of friends and loved ones, and much sorrow as well. You have yet to find that, my child. Your destiny lies beyond.
Beyond what? Amari asked.
I do not know. Some things the spirits keep secret, she chuckled, in spite of everything, and hugged Amari once more.
Chapter 10 The Middle Passage. Afi was right. The next night, the kindly red-headed sailor was nowhere to be seen. Amari was taken to a filthy corner of the ship by a dark-haired, skinny sailor who used her, hurt her, and tossed her back on the deck, bruised and bleeding. All of her dreams finally and forever destroyed. Afi said nothing, but held Amari and rocked her until her tears stopped flowing. The following night, Amari was taken by two sailors. They took turns. She wanted to die. The morning after that brutal assault, Amari spotted Besa and a group of men who were brought on deck. It was the first time she'd seen him since they had been on the ship. He had lost weight, as most of them had, and his body was covered with welts and sores. He made brief eye contact with Amari, a flicker of hope in his eyes for a moment. The pineapple birthmark looked distorted and shrunken. But she could not face him, for she was no longer the innocent girl he had once loved. She no longer felt worthy of his admiration, or even his friendship. Amari turned away from him in shame. The routine of the ship took on a horrible monotony. The everlasting indigo blue of the ocean surrounded them day after day. The copper sun and the piercing paleness of the sky, which were so welcome in the captive's homeland, imprisoned them each hour. Every morning the women were fed, doused with salt water, and made to dance. Oh, how Amari hated that drum! The men were then pulled from the hold, squinting in the bright sunlight, filthy, weak, and almost crippled from being tied down for almost 20 hours each day. More and more bodies were tossed overboard, where the huge gray fish waited hungrily for their meal. Every evening, the sailors prepared greedily for their night of pleasure. Sometimes Amari was rescued by the red-headed sailor, but on most nights, she was just another female body to be used by one of the 40 or so sailors on board that awful ship. A couple of times she had seen the large redhead climbing up to the mast to do the night watch, so she figured that perhaps he did not always have the opportunity to save her from a night of defilement. Or, she thought, perhaps he just did not care that much. Amari no longer smiled. Ever. She learned to harden herself from feelings and emotion, as well as from physical pain. She was, however, grateful for any evening of escape from the other men, and for the large red-headed man's attempts to teach her their language. She learned his name, which was Bill, and how to say yes and no, and quite a few conversational phrases. He showed her how to count using the fingers of her hands. She learned the words hungry and eat, even though hunger was a constant and the food she was given was barely life-sustaining, as well as verbs like try and cry and die. The language of the white skins was strange and fell heavily on her tongue, but she continued eagerly. She gathered words as weapons to be used later. "What's that?" she asked Bill one rainy night, as she pointed to the rain slicker he wore. He told her the name for it, as well as the names of other articles of clothing. He taught her the names of the parts of the body, words for weather, and words for food. She pointed, he named it, she repeated it. He showed her how words connected into phrases. Verbs were difficult for her. "I am Bill," he explained.
"You am Bill," she repeated.
"No,
you say you are Bill."
"I not Bill, I are Amari."
She was often confused, but slowly it made sense. Amari found that she could understand more than she could say, which she knew was an advantage. Sometimes she repeated words and phrases to herself as the men made her dance, or while she was tied up for hours on the deck of the endlessly rocking ship. It kept her from going mad. When Amari awoke one morning, the sky was thick with dark, ominous clouds. Cold winds blasted the deck. The ship rocked violently as waves splashed high over the roping on the sides. The women, drenched and terrified, were flung wildly about, held only by the ropes that tied them to the masts. One woman, whose name was Mosi, screamed with desperation as her daughter, who was about 4 years old, was torn from her arms. At that instant, another huge foaming wave washed over the deck, and the child disappeared with it as it fell back into the ocean. Mosi pulled at her ropes like a crazed animal, broke free, and ran across the deck to the place where her child had disappeared. She looked over the side of the boat and, pointing to a spot some distance away in the water, yelled to the women, "I see her! I see her! Oh, my baby!" Amari pulled at her ropes, but she could do nothing. A sailor had spotted Mosi and headed toward her. She took one look at him, one final look at the women, as if to say farewell, and leaped gracefully into the sea. Amari watched frantically, waiting for someone to rescue them. But the sailors, too busy with the sudden storm, never even bothered to glance overboard to see the fate of the mother and child. They were simply two more dead slaves. They did, however, untie the women then and lead them to the lower deck. It had been many days, perhaps weeks, since they had been in this area of the ship. Amari had lost all count of days and time. The stench, which had been unbearable at the beginning of the voyage, was now almost unbreathable. It seemed that no one had bothered to clean out the lower deck since the voyage began. The men, tied there for over 20 hours a day, had no choice but to lie in the filth. Many of the bottom levels of the shelving were empty, Amari noticed. That was the result of the constant stream of stiff, dead bodies that were tossed overboard each morning, she realized. Amari and the other women splashed slowly through the slime of urine and feces and vomit that covered the floor. Rats, now grown huge and healthy, chewed on the emaciated body of some of the men chained there. Too weak or too tightly chained to shake them off, the men suffered in silent agony. The women were chained to what the sailors call the tween deck. The door of the hold was closed behind them. Amari vomited, unable to fight the nausea. So did many others. Hour after hour, the ship bucked through the storm. Children clutched their mothers. Women moaned. Everyone prayed. At first, Amari prayed for the storm to stop. Soon, she simply wished that the ship would be taken by the storm and sunk to the bottom of the ocean. But no relief was to come that night, nor the next day. The winds kept roaring, the ship rolled, and the slaves chained beneath the decks suffered endlessly. Finally, Amari realized that the movement of the ship had slowed. She could no longer hear the wind. Too weak to move, she lay huddled in a ball, bemoaning the fact that she was still alive. She heard the sound of a door opening. The sailors who entered began to curse at the sight before them. They unchained the women and led them to the deck. They did not bother to tie them, for they were too weak to even stand. Of the 90 women left on board, 16 had died during that storm. 10 of the children had died as well. The women watched with empty eyes as the bodies were tossed overboard. Amari wished that she had been one of them. Chapter 11. Land Ho. Many of the sails and several of the mast poles had been damaged in the storm. Crew members scurried about making repairs. If she listened carefully, Amari could figure out bits and pieces of the conversation between the captain and his crew.
"Can you tell what they say?" Afi asked Amari.
"Not exactly," Amari whispered back. "But they seem to be worried that the ship is damaged."
"That I can see," Afi said with a chuckle. "Perhaps destruction is the only thing these barbarians understand."
"They are headed to something called Carolina," Amari told Afi later that day. "What do you think that means for us?"
"It means that place is where your destiny lies, my child,"
Afi said with assurance.
"And yours as well?" Amari added, almost as a question.
Afi gazed out upon the ocean.
"Afi, your destiny is with me, is it not?"
Amari pleaded desperately. Afi did not look at Amari.
"When I have an answer for you, I will tell you," she said finally.
Amari stopped asking, but her heart was heavy. For the next few days, the slaves were treated a little differently. The men were brought up on deck more often and allowed to stay for longer periods. They all started receiving larger food portions and generous rations of water. The ship's doctor checked each one of them carefully, applying salves to their many wounds and giving medicine to those who appeared to be sickly. The sailors were no longer allowed to molest the women at night. All activity seemed to indicate the end of their journey. Crates and cartons were packed, sails were sewn and repaired, and sailors whistled as they shaved their beards.
"Huh. The sailors seem to be excited to return to their own women,"